Thank you, Susan. It's good to see all of you here this morning. It's my very great pleasure today to introduce Sarah Coakley as our Hickman lecturer this year. Before I do the introduction, let me say something about the plan for this morning's lecture. Professor Coakley is going to lecture, she tells me, for about 50 minutes and then leave some time for questions and answers following. So we'll be able to have some discussion on a topic that is of great interest to, I suspect, all of you here. So when she finishes the lecture, I will come back up here and moderate the Q&A, and we will have folks in the aisles with microphones for those of you who would like to pose a question to Professor Coakley, so you can sharpen your pencils and be prepared with your questions as she lectures. Sarah Coakley is the Norris Hulse Professor of Divinity at Cambridge University in England and also an ordained priest in the Church of England. And before returning to Cambridge a few years ago, she served for 14 years as the Mallinckrodt Professor of Divinity at Harvard Divinity School. One of the first things that needs to be said about Sarah Coakley to place her on the map of the world of theology is that earlier this year she delivered the prestigious Gifford Lectures in Aberdeen, Scotland, under the title Sacrifice Regained, Evolution, Cooperation, and God. For those of you who may not know, being invited to deliver the Gifford Lectures is, for theologians and philosophers, roughly the equivalent of winning the Nobel Prize. We don't have a Nobel Prize in theology, alas, but being invited to deliver the Giffords is an equally prestigious honor. So Sarah Coakley is a world-class philosophical theologian who, as the title of her Gifford Lectures might suggest to you, has been working in recent years, particularly at the cutting edge where theology engages with the sciences. And she is currently at work on what I expect will be a massive four-volume systematic theology, the first volume of which, forthcoming from Cambridge University Press, is entitled God, Sexuality, and the Self, an Essay on the Trinity. So that's Sarah Coakley, the theologian. But the other thing I want to say about Sarah Coakley is about Sarah Coakley, the priest. Having had the privilege of knowing and working with Sarah in various contexts over recent years, I've come to know that her identity as a priest is perhaps the deepest truth about her vocation. She co-edited with former dean of the chapel here, Sam Wells, a book called Praying for England, which incorporates a collection of essays from younger clergy in England about the way in which they exercise their priestly vocation of prayer in parish settings in England. And as you will hear from her, the question of how the priestly vocation is exercised is something that's very much at the heart of her concern. So, in short, Sarah embodies the union of faith and learning that we here at Duke Divinity School seek to cultivate. And it's a great honor to welcome her here as this year's Hickman Lecturer, Professor Sarah Coakley.
Well, first, let me say how delighted and honored I am to be with you at this convocation and pastor's school at Duke. And my thanks especially to Dean Richard Hayes for the invitation and that lovely introduction, to Dr. Ray Barfield, with whom I'm in ongoing conversation about medicine and theology, and not least, Marcia McNutt, for taking such good care of all the practical details of my visit. In what follows, I have three immediate goals in mind, but my undergirding aspiration is to ignite your imaginations and to invite your criticism, born of much experience, as I well know, in the church and the field, about a new possibility for conceiving a replacement for so-called pastoral theology in university divinity schools. This is an ambitious set of ideas, and only a dream at the moment, to be sure. But it is offered on the assumption that if any university could bring it about right now, it would most likely, for various reasons, be Duke that would have the resources and political clout to begin to blaze a new trail. And indeed, as I have discovered even since getting here, there are signs that Duke is indeed starting to explore some such direction. My three immediate goals in this lecture, however, are these. First, I want to cast an eye back at the historical reasons why pastoral theology, or practical theology, so-called, came to have the niche it has in American divinity schools, seminaries, and institutions of clergy learning, in particular within the clinical pastoral education program in hospitals, and why, in my view, it has tragically marginalized itself, both intellectually and politically, as a result. It has, in fact, if my analysis is correct, unwittingly rendered itself strangely ineffectual at the point at which it should be most creative. This is painful stuff, and its historical archaeology is deep, but the story has to be told again with realism, albeit briefly, if another and different story is to be invented for the future. My second goal is not so much historical, but diagnostic. If pastoral theology as such has backed itself into a vanishing corner, what are the deeper structural reasons in contemporary culture and politics why theology to core cannot fully claim its own power, especially in the institutions of healing and punishment outside the church, modern hospitals and prisons, ironically themselves originally Christian inventions, in which it now seeks to bring Christ's light to the world? Here we shall need to look at what are sometimes called wicked problems, problems so deep and intractable as to be invisible, until, that is, we change the name of the game. My third goal is to start to gesture forward to a new constellation of the disciplines of systematic theology, philosophy of religion, and ministry, such as these problems might begin to be addressed, and to embed pedagogy within the university that might question the institutional rigidities that prevent progress. It is not, of course, that there haven't already been many honorable attempts in the last part of the 20th century to effect some such reforms in pastoral theology. But always it seems to me they founder on an implicitly self-denigrating vision of applied theology's place amongst the powerhouses of other institutions, particularly of medicine, public policy, and the law. Of course, it's the much vaunted separation of church and state in this country, blurred as the boundaries often are in practice, which particularly complicates this terrain in the United States and makes the discussion different from that of the established state churches in Northern Europe, even in their currently depotentiated condition. So as I go along, I shall make several autobiographical asides about how what I'm analyzing or proposing has emerged from my own training and experience as an Anglican priest and theologian operating on both sides of the Atlantic. But to repeat, if creative pedagogic and institutional changes are now to start to occur in the repositioning of theology in relation to state institutions, such as prisons and hospitals, I suspect those reforms will need to start from somewhere like here. So first, whence and whither pastoral theology so called? Where did the term come from, and why was the curriculum ever carved up so that pastoral or practical theology occupied a completely different division from systematic theology or theological ethics? The story is complicated, but fortunately there are a number of excellent scholarly treatments of the history involved. In fact, it was in the 1980s and early 90s that theological education seemed to recognize itself in a new crisis in this country, spawned as much by shrinking membership in the Protestant denominations as anything else. A spate of books were published examining the roots and cause of this malaise. Many rightly returned to Schleiermacher's Berlin of the early 19th century, and the fateful moment when it was decided under Schleiermacher's leadership to accommodate theology, and especially the training of ministers in ecclesial theology, in the professional school status at the edges of the new Enlightenment-inspired Humboldt University. As David Kelsey points out in his excellent study Between Athens and Berlin, which came out in 1993, which still repays careful study and sums up much of the debate up till then, this repositioning of theology in the modern Enlightenment vision of the research university left it in a position of considerable ambiguity. On the one hand, it seemed that theology had been rescued honorably from exclusion from the university on any sort of creeping secularist grounds, and its professional status was rendered newly heightened by placing ministerial training on a par with the equivalently rigorous university training for medicine or law. In short, theology had apparently been rescued from potential exile and ghettoization in the seminaries. On the other hand, two other things had also happened simultaneously, which were less remarked on at the time, but were to affect future replications of this model in the liberal university divinity schools of the New World in particular ways. First, Schleiermacher's own systematic theology, the Glaubenslehre, famously turned to feeling, not feelings, note, as the fundamental root of our relation to God, and then proceeded to unpack the religious consciousness, as he put it, as he reordered the classic loci of the Calvinist dogmatic tradition. This involved, in Schleiermacher's case, a highly complex set of what he called borrowings from other branches of study, ethics, hermeneutics, philosophy of religion. But at the heart of Schleiermacher's vision lay an intentional evasion from making Christianity theology reliant on either rational demonstration or ethical imperatives. Whilst it had obvious short-term advantages in the wake of Kant's critiques, and indeed, on my reading of Schleiermacher, was even an uncannily brilliant anticipation of certain non-foundationalist philosophical moves of the later 20th century, it nonetheless sowed certain unfortunate seeds for the rather different idea of an affectively oriented and even anti-rational rendition of theology, which would have its proper place in the professional formation of the clergy for the church's practical business of pastoral service. More of that in a moment. Secondly, and here the comparison with what happened in contrast in Oxford and Cambridge in England is instructive, Schleiermacher's modern idea of the theological professional school had actually edged theology forever out of the preeminent position it had exercised as queen of the sciences in the great medieval universities of Europe, and which place, though duly modified, it had nonetheless retained at the Reformation in England in a new form with the establishment of the Regius Chairs of Divinity at both Cambridge and Oxford after Henry VIII's dissolution of the monasteries. The birth of actual theological colleges in England for the formation of clergy outside the parish, previously they had simply been apprenticed there under an experienced priest mentor, think Jane Austen here, came much later in the late 19th century. We didn't have theological colleges or schools until then. And then they were clustered in Oxford and Cambridge first around the existing theological faculties, which still maintained their intellectual place at the heart of the university, alongside philosophy, mathematics, classics, and the other scientific disciplines. So in England, one can still read, as we put it, theology as an undergraduate. It's one of the subjects alongside the classic disciplines. Truth, rational truth, was still implicitly theology's business in England, even though the training of clergy was merely derivative from it on the edges of the university. Serious underminings of the position of theology in that status came only later with the erosions of secularization. But the matter had taken this different turn in Berlin under Schleiermacher, and perhaps fatally so. David Kelsey sums up Schleiermacher's ambiguous inheritance in Berlin in contrast in this way. This is page 16 of his book. I quote, Schleiermacher's argument seems to leave him in a bind. If we agree with him, he has given a strong sociological reason, for including theology in a research university. That is, as providing for the religious needs of society. But the very notion of a research university seems necessarily, on the other hand, to exclude theology, even on Schleiermacher's own rendition, close quote. Something had shifted here decisively, and ground had been given. Schleiermacher's professional theology was in danger ultimately of becoming practical or pastoral theology in a later American reception of his inheritance, loosed significantly from the moorings of rational accountability at the central debating table of the university. I am jumping over many complex historical developments when I now mention, in addition, the extraordinary impact of modern psychology on clerical training in North America in the 20th century and beyond. We don't have this in England in the same way, largely through the influence of, who is this? Anton Boysen. Himself, amazingly, a recurrent psychotic and the founder of the clinical pastoral education movement. You didn't know that? Boysen's genius was to insist that clergy are best formed by the living documents presented to them in the forms of the lives and sufferings of the mentally ill. As one who has passed through this CPE fire myself, and I suspect that's what conjoins us all in this room, in both a general hospital and a mental hospital, I can testify that those living documents of the suffering are the ones which teach one most profoundly. But unfortunately, the theology that goes along with CPE is often, I won't mince my words, derisory, mere anti-intellectual shavings from the table of university theological discourse. Kelsey and others have highlighted how the Berlin model of theological education clashed and mingled in America with what Kelsey calls the older Athens model, the idea that theological formation consists not in professional skills as such, but in a process of paideia, or personal transformation, en route to theological maturity. On this view of theological education, you have to suffer, as it were, to become a priest or minister. Unfortunately, this forced marriage of Berlin and Athens produced some strange offspring in this country, ably assisted by the creeping psychologization of theology in clerical training rendered by Boysen and others. Pastoral theology became a matter of the acquisition of certain professional skills, with theological accompaniments which were at best derivative from systematic theology, and at worst, anti-intellectual replacements of systematic theology, with seemingly virtuous goals such as global justice, which were strangely untheorized. Yet the division between pastoral or practical theology and systematic theology had by this time become cavernous and deeply problematic in many a university divinity school. Pastoral theology, although no one was willing to say this out loud, was somehow intellectually second rate. And when ranged against the bombastic new intellectual confidence of a theological movement such as John Milbank's Radical Orthodoxy, with its accompanying denigration of liberation theology and its resistance to all collusions with social science renditions of the theological terrain, Boysen and all his works looked elderly, frail, and radically unchic. This is Boysen in old age. Yet by this time, CPE was the one form of undertaking for ministry that all denominations, and indeed liberal Judaism, ironically, could agree on as absolutely indispensable. At Harvard Divinity School, no one could ever agree on anything theologically, but the one thing they could agree on was that everybody had to do CPE. It was just that it had got unhitched en route from any serious intellectual engagement with systematic theological questions. Now, it is at this point that I must, I hope without indulgence, insert some very brief autobiographical asides about what I learnt in the course of my own training for the priesthood more than a decade ago now. For to a significant extent, it is fueling what I want to say today about pastoral theology. First, I was, of course, an academic theologian and philosopher of religion long before I was a priest. And the shift into clerical training made that a doubly difficult transition. All priestly formation, as we know, is necessarily a sort of breaking, however blessed. And certainly, I did not escape such. I went through all the painful processes of humiliation that my own students were required to undertake. And I am glad and grateful, at least in retrospect, that that was the case. An internship in a Boston jail, the Suffolk County House of Correction, where I taught practices of silent prayer to the inmates and prayed with them each week. A year's varied CPE in a Catholic hospital in the Boston area. And summers at the mental hospital outside Oxford, where my English parish was also based. These were the contexts of my ministerial formation. But there were severe frustrations, even in the deep stretching and fulfillment that this training involved. First, the theology that was on offer to accompany the profundity of the living documents, in Boysen's terms, I encountered, was, as I've already mentioned, thin gruel indeed. If this was pastoral theology, then I felt I could well do without it. Most of it was warmed over titbits from an earlier generation of systematics, one which had in any case signally failed to reignite excitement about pastoral ministry in itself. The rest of it, most of it, was lightweight spirituality, so-called, which acted as a sort of palliative, but did not probe the big theological and philosophical questions about unjust suffering and untimely death that any CPE candidate will inevitably encounter in the wards. How can we teach CPE without seriously teaching the problem of evil in the most acute and sophisticated way that philosophy of religion can deliver? So the pastoral theology that was served up to us trainees was, I'm afraid I found, decidedly substandard. Secondly, I was struck that in my time in the Boston jail, I was up against a nexus of issues which no one seemed adequately to have probed into relation to one another, or at least no one seemed to have probed theologically. There was the harsh legal response to minor drug offenses, which kept up to half of the young black men of that end of Boston between the ages of 17 and 23 in that jail at any one time. There was the racialized policy of policing in the black area of Boston. There was the deliberate brutalizing and further criminalizing of young men in impossibly cramped cell conditions in the jail. And there was the scarcely veiled threat by the jail authorities towards chaplains and other well-wishers that any dimension to their ministry that might be construed as politically subversive would be harshly riposted and repressed. I was once shut up myself in the jail for 3 hours as a punishment for something I'd done. The fact that corporate prayer and stillness was obviously an act of resistance and solidarity against brutality and bullying did not escape the prison guards. But they chose to condone it, provided no actual outbreaks of overt resistance emerged out of it. In short, the chaplain was there merely to slide surreptitiously through any gaps left by an unwieldy and often brutal system of justice. In the hospital, in contrast, the problem, one might say, was the opposite. Visiting was allowed and actively encouraged, despite the inevitable element of chaos that's produced in the wards. But religion as such, even in a Roman Catholic hospital such as I served in Brighton, Massachusetts, was kept, in a way, tightly under wraps, at least as far as its inherent theological power was concerned. I was given an absurd badge when I arrived, which announced that I was a spiritual services intern. I was seemingly supplying goods competitively, just as any good business person would do. That's what the Roman Catholic hospital did with Protestant interns. The overriding atmosphere was thus of pluralistic political correctness, a sort of naive religious preferentialism. Even the form that you filled in when you came into the hospital said religious preference, like choosing a fried egg rather than a scrambled one for breakfast. And this bespoke, I think, underlyingly an unthought-through ethical relativism. But at the same time, one was aware of the juggernaut of Roman Catholic authority, ready to impose itself if necessary. A fleet of Roman Catholic nuns were ever in the corridors, waiting to post sacraments into dying mouths. I was struck again by the strange lack of robustly theological thinking, despite the fact that my own patients often raised the most pressing and interesting theological questions. And at the same time, by the way, that doctors in the hospital invariably ignored chaplains, however effective they were being with the more difficult patients. Only once in a whole year at the hospital, I wonder whether this has been your experience too, did an actual doctor ask my advice as a chaplain or request that I do something to aid his attempts to get patient cooperation. A psychotic patient with diabetes was resisting standard tests for vital signs, and in some exasperation and desperation, he turned to me for aid. But for the most part, the clinical medical behemoth was taken to be unassailable, even in a Catholic hospital. And that same behemoth had no answers to the pressing existential questions about frailty, death, and final purpose, which hung so palpably about the wards. The question that pressed for me then, as I reached the end of a life-changing diaconal year in the jail and on the wards, for which I have to thank the Lilly Foundation, which actually paid for me to take time out from Harvard to undergo this personally demanding transformation. But the question that pressed was this: how could one avoid, as a priest theologian, the merely what I call heartwarming stories approach, the goofy approach to the theological realities of the jail and hospital? Institutions which ironically had originally been created in the early modern period for Christian purposes, but which had long been ceded to secularized forces in medicine and the criminal justice system. What sort of robust theological approach would not merely succumb to those forces in advance, selling out precisely by means of a weakened form of compliant and psychologized pastoral theology that offended nobody? How might one rethink the relation of high theological intellect, properly affective response to patients or inmates, and insightful institutional and political nous, so as to train students from the start in the university to negotiate the boundaries between theology, medicine, public policy, and law in a new way, and to resist concocting a poor relation type of theological discourse just to prove that it is pastoral? How, in short, could systematic theology become properly pastoral again without losing any of its intellectual rigor or coherence? In the remaining portions of this paper, I shall start to answer, or at least attempt to answer, these questions. Ray Barfield has written of late of wicked problems, as he calls it, that afflict the realm of religion and medicine. He puts it thus in a recent document, I quote: "A wicked problem is a problem that is so complex and challenging that you cannot even say what it is until you start to try and solve it and fail. Then you ask, why did that fail? And once you understand why you fail, you understand more about the problem." Such, he suggests, is the state of affairs today when modern medicine pursues its denial of death at all costs, literally and economically, and resolutely refuses space for challenges from a properly theological account of our human frailty and mortality. Such wicked problems do indeed constitute the stuff of pastoral work in jail and hospital. And I want to spell this point out a little further before suggesting the beginning of a project to ameliorate the wicked problem of pastoral theology to core. Consider the act of prayer, especially corporate silent prayer in the jail context. To the cynical guard on duty, quizzically checking through the picture window, this might seem weird, if not pointless, this activity. Why are these men, well known as violent and disruptive presences, suddenly disposing themselves into silent and peaceful solidarity with one another? Is not the whole jail system designed to keep them at odds, and so to divide and rule them? I have written elsewhere in the Christian Century of the extraordinary spiritual and theological power of such a regular practice in the jail context, when undertaken well. Bodies actually change and acquire new stature. Strange and unexpected friendships develop in a context in which often up to this moment it was too dangerous to close one's eyes in the presence of other people. The hostilities of the prison system are subtly bucked in a new way by sheer patient shared vulnerability. Young men recently disoriented by drug withdrawal acquire a means of resistance to physical craving. As one extraordinary inmate remarked to me after only his first session of such practice, I quote, I'll never forget this, "I get it," he said. "This is to teach me patience. This is the opposite of drugs." There is, of course, no magic bullet here. Embodied practice is of the essence. But with it, implicitly, necessarily goes a theology, which the men in my care began to speak out for themselves. And they were thrilled by my taking in various snippets from the Desert Fathers. They were thrilled by the realization that Christian monasticism started in Africa, and by such statements in the Desert Fathers as, "Remain in your cell and you will be transformed." Here was a theology coming out of transformation, a theology of forgiveness and redemption, for which purposes, ironically, the modern prison system was, of course, originally designed. A theology of the body and its labile capacity for change in response to the spirit's calling. A theology of race and its radical undoing and reconfiguration through the liberation of prayer. For if, as Jay Carter has argued here at Duke, the Enlightenment concocted the modern category of race and made it the unacceptable opposites of its philosophical enlightening project, then in reverse, and by the mysterious and ironically dark processes of the transformative practices of silence, the crushing restriction of that white man's epistemic project begins to be undone. And even the fearfulness of the whole solitary confinement starts to lose its destructive and disorienting force as the self struggles towards a new integration and poise. So this is a theological project, a substantial and systematic project intimately connected to the doctrine of God, the doctrine of the human, and the doctrine of redemption. It follows then that to trivialize it as a mere pastoral theological mopping up of distress is also to trivialize its potential political importance and impact. Yet something else needs to happen if this set of theological insights are to join hands with the exponents of legal history and criminology to explain how on earth we have arrived with the jail system as we have it in predominantly non-white parts of our major cities, where vast quantities of young black men are kept out of sight, and how we can transform and ameliorate the status quo. The wicked problem will remain wicked then if the theological dimension of the analysis is repressed. It does indeed represent an irreducible dimension of the realities of the jail and of the inmates' capacity for change and hope. The most repeated question I had from these young men was, how can we do this wonderful thing together when we get out? Where can we do it? Very difficult question, actually. Let me permit myself now a second example of a wicked pastoral problem, this time from my work in the United Kingdom, in my parish just outside Oxford, to which I returned every summer for nearly a decade while I was still teaching at Harvard. The church here in Littlemore, outside Oxford, was built by John Henry Newman in the years before his conversion. And it was constructed in a village that had long been known for its social difficulties and is still known for such. There are several murders there each year, even now. And at the time of the Reformation, the one monastery in the village was easily dissolved because it had been turned by its last abbess into a brothel. Even as Newman was raising money to build this church, in his kind of romantic fantasy of neo-Gothic restoration, the city of Oxford was also erecting, just down the road from the church, its poorhouse version of Victorian provision for the mentally ill. It built another mental hospital for dons who went bonkers, but that was inside the university sphere. Right from the start, then, the mental hospital at Littlemore and the church have had a symbiotic relationship. And when inmates of the hospital feel just well enough to take a stroll to the village, it is always the church that they visit first, many of them fired up initially by flights of religious psychotic fantasy. We have grown used as a parish to certain minor disruptions and excitements during the services, and the parishioners are remarkably patient and welcoming of all comers. I well recall one regular schizophrenic visitor whose visage, clothes, and hair were frightening enough to make people actually cross the road when they saw him coming, remarking to me after a service, "I really like it here. The best bit is when everyone shakes my hand." What then exactly is the wicked problem enshrined here? The perennial issue for us clergy in the parish is that the medical treatment at the hospital is almost entirely drugs-based and tends to see all religious interest as pathological and delusory. The official National Health Line does not regard chapel worship at the hospital as anything other than a distracting aside. But the patients know better. I well recall a day when I was celebrating the Eucharist in the chapel there, and an extraordinarily large and frightening man from the locked unit of the hospital who had committed a serious crime arrived handcuffed to a rather diminutive attendant, and he stayed silent until the moment where we got to the prayers of the people, which at that service was always the high point of the service. And then he spoke up and he said, "Well, I've come to pray for Bernard." He didn't say who Bernard was, but he had an absolutely clear understanding that it was his duty, in the spirit of Mark 2 and parallels, to lift up Bernard and bring his need to us in the chapel. Now, the fact that in its psychotic form, religious fantasy is indeed delusory and sometimes dangerous does not detract from the importance of theological thinking and doing in the patient's path to recovery or stabilization. One of our long-term parishioners descended into hell, as he put it, as a schizophrenic for the first time when he was an undergraduate at Cambridge. He remains subject to sudden reversals of health, but has been able in recent years to return to part-time extramural study and to live in a halfway house most of the time. During his many years associated with the hospital, either in it or nearby, he has amazingly himself formed a support group for other schizophrenics, which has the chapel at the hospital and the parish church as its two points of worshiping focus. What is remarkable about this group, and the clergy regularly go on afternoon walks with it, is that they defy the normal patterns of schizophrenia by refusing to allow themselves to become isolates. Moreover, they report to me that if they are faithful in their commitments to worship together at the chapel or church, their voices, their disruptive voices in their heads, are significantly dampened and alleviated, and they feel a greater strength to resist despair. Theological conversations with this group of people are invariably rich and strange. Sometimes, to be sure, they are obsessed with questions of blood guilt, atonement, and redemption. But often their ideas are uncannily theologically acute and richly laden with biblical allusion. For them, the parish church is a place of communal sanctuary and often a place of real healing. We have by now seen the wicked problem dangers of a merely anodyne pastoral theology approach to fundamental issues in chaplaincy work in the prison and hospital. As things stand, there are intractable limitations on chaplaincy work in those places and its efficacy, granted the huge and unchallenged power of the secularized institutions of prison and hospital and what they think they are doing. The question I now want to ask as a climax and end to this paper is this. What can we imagine would change the current status quo, in which pastoral theology is a merely ancillary stepchild, both to the powers of modern clinical medicine and to the criminal justice system, and even to the systematic theology being brokered at high levels in the PhD programs of the university? How can we alleviate the seemingly intractable theological limitations that chaplaincy work finds itself in, and at the same time expand its goals and vision? How can the medical and legal professions be persuaded that there are genuinely theological materials that fall under their purview and demand creative attention? Let me end, therefore, with a short section entitled Allowing Oneself a Dream, How Duke and Other University Divinity Schools of Like Mind Could Blaze a New Trail. I have only two highly practical suggestions to make at the close of this lecture, and I hope they are not overly utopian on the one hand, or in any way insulting on the other to the existing status quo. After I had finished my ministerial training and became a priest associate in a parish in the Boston suburbs, I started to investigate the possibility of teaching shared courses with members of the medical and law schools at Harvard. The purpose of this was to bring a whole group of highly motivated and creative students together, the students who would guide through leadership the next generation of thinking. From the medical and divinity school for one course entitled Medicine and Religion, and from the law and divinity school for another entitled Justice and Mercy in Jewish and Christian Tradition and American Penal Theory. In concert with two outstanding senior faculty members from these two other institutions, courses were devised that involved thematic treatments of key controversial topics, for instance, pain, death, healing in the medicine and religion course, and punishment, restitution, and forgiveness in the law and religion course. In each case, a cluster of carefully chosen short interdisciplinary readings were set for each major topic, and a probing theological question set alongside a more practical or medical scientific set of issues for discussion. The students were also paired up with students from the other institution for joint projects and tutorials. Had I had further time and had I stayed longer at Harvard, I would have continued these courses and have orchestrated a set of constellating case study questions which would throw light on the interdependence of theological and medical or legal understanding in the case of each such question. As I see it, there is no reason why absolutely intellectually demanding case study work, utilizing the Socratic method, shouldn't be a norm for theological interaction, as it is elsewhere in the university, especially in the law school at Harvard. It is hard to say whether proposed courses such as these, instituted in friendship between senior professors of stature in the different schools, and training the next generation of top students together in thinking their disciplines through in relation to each other, could, over the years, effect the desired opening up of genuine dialogue between the disciplines, such as to affect the institutional structures of our country. But at the very least, it seems to me, this plan could help students practice what it is to think out of the usual boxes in relation to a wicked problem. Only consider the wicked problem of healthcare reform in this country and the utilization of precious resources for the right medical and spiritual goals. Here, indeed, is an intractable political issue which combines medical, legal, policy, and theological considerations all together. As Ray Barfield here has started to spell out in his own recent work, something has to be done at Duke in thinking through these problems if the Obamacare project isn't going to founder at the state level. These three or four-way conversations are urgent and immediate then, whether or not they can become embedded into the curriculum as a discipline means of interdisciplinary discussion, in which theology no longer takes the the subordinate role. My last remaining suggestion is correlative to this and concerns how systematic theology is to be written and promulgated, given the need to link it tightly now to political conversations which borrow, as Schleiermacher put it, from its various systematic loci. The urgency here is to keep what was formerly the disconnected and depotentiated pastoral theology tightly linked to the heart of the systematic and philosophical project. But this, as I submit in my own new systematic work, the beginning of my systematic theology spells out a new method along these lines, can only be done well if systematic theology knows itself to be necessarily embedded in the field and to have its doctrines tested and purified as much through an analysis of the prayer and worship that sustains it as in its outworkings in the world, and particularly in the state institutions of healing and punishment. This is a large and ambitious task, to be sure, but its challenge opens up the possibility of a number of different reconfigurations of the systematic task, and a rich set of possibilities for what has traditionally been called political rather than systematic theology. But again, it would seem to me preferable not to divorce the political from the systematic, any more than to divorce the pastoral from the systematic. What I have myself proposed in my own new project of systematics is that we consider a title like Théologie Totale, Total Theology, on the analogy of the French L'Histoire Totale school, in which every level and context of theology's operation is systematically considered. Let me just return to the much maligned Schleiermacher in closing. In resisting his move to professionalize theology from the outset, I do not wish, of course, to be heard as supporting unprofessional accounts of the theological task. Far from it. There are skills that we need to learn as ministers and priests. Rather, the vision I have started to lay before you today would include nothing less than a reconfiguration of the divisions of the curriculum, such that division of ministry would no longer sit alongside the other divisions as glommed onto the edge, practical rather than strictly academic. Then at last it would become apparent that the interdisciplinary subtlety required of so much of the best work in theology that is girded for action in the world requires more intelligence, more intellectual input, more verve, and more imagination than a theology entirely spun out of taking thought. And if such theology is to prove its worth, it will be the first to acknowledge that its outworkings are embodied transformations, forms of prayer and witness that do not simply link to law and medicine, but have the capacity to energize and transform even them, marking them with the sign of the cross. Thank you for your time and attention.